Okay, here we go. We have to finish. Let's see. Okay, we need to finish just a little bit on the immunologic methods that we didn't get to last time. Okay, we talked about precipitation and agglutination and a quick slide test. One of the newest things that's just kind of working its way into the laboratory, into the micro-laboratory, is the nucleic acid probes, or nucleic acid testing. We're not going to go through the principle of Southern blot and Western blot. You probably know that anyway. You know what PCR is. So we do use PCR to amplify the DNA of the organism, and then we can use nucleic acid probes. Okay, what a probe is, you probably already know this anyway, is we, after we culture the DNA, or after we culture the bacteria, then we take the DNA and split it into the single strands, and then we can usually purchase these probes, which is part of the strand that is complementary to the strand of the bacteria, only it's labeled with a fluorescent label or a chemiluminescent label. This probe, then, if it finds the complementary strand, if the bacteria is there with that complementary strand, it'll bind to it, and a hybrid will form, and then we can measure it. So the advantage to this, obviously, is its specificity. It's not going to bind to any other complementary strand. Specificity, sensitivity. So currently, these are in use in very few cases, but usually you have to culture the organism first, and then you can apply the probe to it. What the ultimate goal is to be able to make these tests sensitive enough that they can use the probe on the sample. So a sputum sample, for example. Use the probe to detect mycobacterium bacteria because that takes so long to culture. So that's one of the advantages of doing the probes. And it will be you people in the laboratory that will be doing these kinds of tests. So that's exciting. Okay, last thing I want to cover for immunology purposes are the rapid methods. You've all probably heard of the rapid strep test. Anybody here had rapid strep testing done? Some of you. Okay, they just take a throat swab, right? And they can do this right in the physician's office. Usually takes 10 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever, depending on what method they use. But what they're doing is extracting the antigen. So the organism, the strep organism, is on the swab. They put it in some reagent, extract the antigen, and then apply that to the little cassette here, and we get certain color changes or icons or whatever to indicate whether it's positive or not. So the advantage to this, of course, is it's rapid, and it is usually very specific. If it's positive, it's positive for strep. But the sensitivity is a problem. If it's negative, then technically it should be followed up by another throat swab sent to the lab for culture. So two throat swabs should be taken. If the rapid test is positive, you can dispense with the second one. But if it's negative, it should be sent to the lab to follow up. Many docs don't do that, however. They just say if it's negative, you don't have strep. And that's what we're missing. So by doing that, by not sending it to the lab for culture. We are going to do a rapid strep test, but it will be later on in the semester. We don't have time to do it right now, so we're going to do that later in the semester, just so you can see how fun it is. Okay, let's move on to the topic for today, which is today and next Tuesday. Remember, Monday is a holiday.
Yay.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
Supposed to say boo or point.
We are having lecture.
Or no, we're not having lecture on Tuesday. We're having lab on Tuesday.
And exam.
And quiz on Tuesday. Yeah. So I'm going to go through some, we're going to be doing staffs and strep next week.
Yes.
And then on Wednesday we have a lecture and we'll finish up with actually the disease states. Okay, so what is this? Gram-positive pop sign. That one happens to be mobile. Okay, first of all, skin. Three layers of skin. The epidermis is the outer layer. Then underneath that is the dermis, which is the connective tissue layer. And then below that is the fat layer, the subcutaneous layer. Okay, the epidermis is several layers thick, but it's a very harsh environment, so there aren't very many organisms that can live on the skin. There are some staph and some strep that live there, but most other organisms can't. We have hair shafts that penetrate throughout, sweat pores, there's nerves, blood vessels. There are some organisms that colonize the hair shafts, and occasionally we get infection there. But usually to get an infection of the skin, there has to be some abrasion, some cut, some trauma to the epidermis, because most organisms cannot penetrate, and that's the first line of defense, that barrier there. Most organisms cannot penetrate that unless there's some trauma to that. So the skin is a very good protective mechanism. Okay, microorganisms of the skin, normal flora. So you need to know normal flora, and you need to know pathogens for each of these organ systems. Okay, we have a gram-positive rod known as Pyrenibacterium pseudodiphtheriticum. Can you say that? Pyrenibacterium pseudodiphtheriticum. Okay, remember, if you're going to walk the walk, you've got to talk the talk. So you have to be able to say these things. We usually just refer to them as diphtheroids. This is what they look like, just normal flora. We're not going to worry about them. Some staph is normal flora of the skin, particularly staph epidermidis, but some people also will harbor staph aureus in the skin. Micrococci is just another gram-positive cocci. Pterosporin is... an anaerobe, we're not going to really talk about that. We'll do anaerobes towards the end of the semester. Okay, pathogens are primarily Staph aureus, Strep pyogenes, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which we're going to talk about later, Propionibacterium acnes, which is a anaerobe. There are some viruses, like chickenpox, fungi, particularly Candida albicans, and we're going to talk about that later when we get into mycology at the very end of the semester. So this week, or today and next week, we're going to focus on the staphs and the streps. Those are the only organisms we're going to do.
Question?
No.
Oh,
yes.
In the previous line, is this staphylococci aureus is normal?
It can be. Some people can carry staph aureus on the skin, particularly the nasal passages. So it can be normal flora, but usually it's a pathogen.
What does it do for normal flora for us?
Takes up space. So pathogens have less space. Produces, it might, well, it utilizes nutrients, so there's less nutrients available for pathogens. Just the pretty much the same thing that other normal flora do. Okay, staph, the genus of staph. Gram-positive cocci in clusters. You can't sneak in. We can see you. Okay, this is what it looks like on gram stain. Clusters, we usually refer to them as clusters of grapes. Usually, the main purpose of gram stain is to determine if it's gram-positive or negative. Positive is purple. And if you don't understand the principle of gram stain, probably explained in chapter one of the textbook, but it's based on this construction of the cell wall, the peptidoglycan of the cell wall. So you need to go back and review that if you don't know that or remember it. Okay, so the purpose of the gram stain is primarily to determine if it's gram-positive or negative and if it's cocci or rods. Staph will usually be in clusters, but they may not be. So you can't always determine if it's staph or strep just from the gram stain. Okay, staph are catalase positive. That's one of the first tests we're going to do. And the way we do catalase is we take a glass slide. You all have a box of glass slides now. Take one slide, put one drop of 3% hydrogen peroxide on the slide. Take a little bit of the organism. You don't need much. You can use your needle or loop. And just swish it around in the drop of hydrogen peroxide. You're looking for effervescence, which is bubbling. Okay? You see immediate bubbling, that's positive. What's happening is the organism, staph, produces the enzyme catalase, which splits hydrogen peroxide into water and oxygen. So you're seeing the oxygen bubble. If it's negative, you don't see any bubbles. You cannot put a drop of hydrogen peroxide right on the plate. Some people do that on the plate when we're talking about sheep blood agar, because the red cells have catalase in them. So you could get a false positive reaction. So you have to put it on a glass slide, take a little bit of the organism, put it in here, and swish it around, look for bubbling. Okay, now let's get into species. We're going to do three species of staph. Even though there are many species, we're only going to talk about three. Okay, staph aureus is the main pathogen. We have to be able to differentiate this from the other two species. We're going to do a coagulase test. It's coagulase positive. Coagulase comes in a little vial. It's in the freezer, so you just go to the freezer, take the vial out, put it in a water bath so you thaw it. There's about a half a mil of fibrinogen or serum in there, so you thaw it out, and then you inoculate that with your pure culture. Remember, everything has to be pure culture once you've identified or isolated the staph aureus. Then you inoculate it, pretty good inoculum, into the little vial. And what coagulase does is that it's an enzyme produced by staph aureus that converts fibrinogen into fibrin, and we'll get this fibrin clot in there. And then you tip tube afterwards, and if you get clot in there, it won't run down the side of it. If it's negative, it'll run down the side. There's two types of coagulase. There's free and bound. Bound coagulase is bound to the cell wall. Not all staph aureus produce bound coagulase. So there's a very quick test for coagulase in which you can just take a drop. It's like the catalase test. You can just take a drop of coagulase, put some of the organism in the drop, and look for clumping. But we're not going to do that test because some staph aureus do not produce the bound. So if it's negative, we have to do the tube test anyway. So we're just going to go straight to the tube test. So you just inoculate the tube. That's the free. So it will produce the coagulase free into the environment, converting fibrinogen to fibrin and forming the clot. Stick it back in the 37-degree water bath. Oftentimes you can read a positive within 4 hours, but we're probably not going to come back in 4 hours and check it, so we'll just stick it in the water bath and read it the next day. Now the little vials tend to float on the surface, so what we found is the best thing to do is put the vial inside a glass tube and then put that in a rack so that it stays in the water, in the 37-degree water bath. Okay, some staph aureus have a yellow pigmentation, colonies. What does the word aureus mean? It means golden. Okay? So I put a plus or minus here because they don't all have that yellow or golden pigmentation, but that's one thing you can look for to help you identify. Most of them are beta-hemolytic, but again, I put a plus minus because some of them are not beta-hemolytic. You cannot always rely on that criteria, but if you see a catalase-positive organism that it gram-positive epoxide that is yellow and beta-hemolytic, is most likely staph aureus. Okay, it's lysostaphin sensitive. Oh, here's the beta hemolysis that you can see, hopefully. Okay, lysostaphin is, we take a equal quantity of lysostaphin and the organism in here. Lysostaphin is an enzyme that splits certain linkages in the peptidoglycan cell wall of staph aureus. So if it is staph aureus, it will split those linkages and cause the culture, the broth, to be clear. If it is not staph aureus, if it's another staph or micrococci, it does not split those linkages, and so the broth stays cloudy. Some labs will use a lysostaphin test. We are not going to use lysostaphin. Most labs stick to the coagulase test. That's one that's been around for a long time, and it's a pretty easy one. So that's what we're going to do. Okay, do you remember what DNA's auger looks like? What color is it? Start with blue. Okay, what's a positive reaction?
Clearing.
Okay, a halo, a clearing around the colony. So staph aureus is positive. DNA is positive. We're not going to use the DNA's auger again. Some labs will use it, but it tells us pretty much the same thing as coagulase, so we're not going to do both of those. What's MSA? What does it stand for? Okay, what does it look like? Uninoculated.
It's kind of light.
It's what?
It's pink. Light red.
Okay, kind of a reddish, pinkish color. Okay, so a negative, it stays reddish, pinkish. Organisms will grow on it. Some staph will grow on it, but it doesn't change. What's a positive color?
Yellow.
Yellow. What's happening? Fermenting mannitol, changing the indicator. Okay. So staph aureus can ferment mannitol, and it can also tolerate staph, not just staph aureus, but staph, other staph that grow, can tolerate the high salt concentration. So 5% sodium chloride. Okay. Now, what does PEA stand for? We use that one.
Phenol alcohol.
And what is it used for? Selective for gram-positive toxite. Gram-positive toxite will grow, but it inhibits gram-negative rods. So we did an E. coli on there. Did you find that the E. coli grew, but it was very, very tiny? Okay. So we can't ever say 100% it won't grow, but you can see compared to what E. coli looked like on sheep blood auger, that it was tiny, tiny inhibited. So PEA is selective for gram-positive toxite. There is another media called CNA, which stands for cholestanolytic acid. It's really essentially the same thing as PEA, just different ingredients, but it's selective for gram-positive toxite. Some labs will use CNA instead of PEA, but you don't use them both because they do the same thing. So it just is the preference of the laboratory is what they want to use. Okay, some people, up to 30% of people, can be carriers of Staph aureus. As I mentioned, they can carry it on their skin. Usually they're carriers in the oral cavity or the nasal passages. And so they can get it on their hands and spread it that way, and it would be pathogenic to others. Oftentimes you see carriers in the hospital, the nursing staff, physicians, whatever, because they come in contact with it so often that it just adapts to their oral cavity or their nasal passages. So that's one reason why you need to wash hands frequently when you're in the hospital.
If a patient has a staph infection, do you ever get rid of it, or does it stay in your system?
No, you can get rid of it.
You get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you need to get rid of it. If it's a patient, if it's like people that just are working in that environment constantly, then it would eventually become normal for them and stay with it. But if it starts out as an infection, then you need to get rid of it. Okay, let's go on to Staph epidermidis. We need to be able to identify this and speciate it, separated from Staph aureus. Okay, this is normal flora, skin, primarily on the skin in the oral cavity. It is coagulase negative, so we'll do the same coagulase test, but we won't see the fibrin clot. It'll just be running. The next thing we do is a novobiacin test. Okay, novobiacin is a little disc, an antibiotic. Novobiacin is an antibiotic, and it's on a disc, just like those discs that we used yesterday. We do the novobiacin test on sheep blood auger. This is what it looks like. And we can conserve media, so you can just use half the plate. This is Staph epidermidis, which is often a very white-colored colony, and gamma hemolytic. Once in a while, rarely, you'll see a baby hemolytic Staph epidermidis, but usually it's white-colored gamma hemolytic. So you streak for confluent growth on half the plate, put the disc right in the middle, there's a novobiacin disc, and then incubate it, and the next day you have to measure the diameter of the zone size, just like we're going to do today for Kirby Bowers. This has to be greater than 16 millimeters to be sensitive. So Staph epidermidis is sensitive to novobiacin. It can be a pathogen, particularly in compromised hosts whose immune system is not functioning particularly well. Their defenses are lowered, so that Staph epidermidis can become a pathogen. It can colonize prosthetic devices like artificial heart valves or hip prosthesis, or those kinds of things. And we talked about it being a pathogen in the blood. We'll talk about that more when we get to blood cultures. Okay, so we can't just disregard it always as normal flora. But usually on the skin oral cavity, it is normal flora. Okay, third staph we're going to speciate is Staph saprophyticus. Okay, Staph saprophyticus is also coag negative. It is novobiacin resistant. So we're going to do a novobiacin test for Staph saprophyticus. Same thing with confluent growth. Put our disc there. Remember, anytime we use these discs or do any other biochemical tests, these have to be pure cultures. So we can't have mixed cultures. We can't have contamination. That's why we have to get good isolation when we're streaking. We measure the diameter, if there is any zone, but it has to be 16 millimeters or less to be resistant. So that's how we differentiate saprophyticus from epidermidis. It's based on the novobiacin.
How did they come up with 16 millimeters?
Just studies that they done with known colonies of Saprophyticus and Epidermidis. And that's the way you differentiate it using those biases. Saprophyticus can be a pathogen, particularly urinary tract infection. And we see that mostly in young, sexually active women. It can be a common pathogen for urinary tract infections. Okay, let's move on. Oh, everybody wait. Okay. No naps. Okay, let's move on to strep. Okay, strep are gram-positive cocci in chains. Okay, so they usually look like this. Some are longer chains, some are short chains, but you might see clusters. When you do a gram stain, you look at several different fields, and you get the most predominant picture. So in some cases, you might see some clusters, but you just keep looking, and the most predominant picture you get should be chains if it's strep, should be clusters if it's staph. But again, we can't always tell from the gram stain whether it's staph or strep. All we can tell sometimes is that it's just gram-positive cocci. So then we do, what test are we going to do next to differentiate staph and strep? We're going to do a catalase. That's the next thing we do. So strep or catalase negative. And that then differentiates our staph and strep. Okay, originally strep was differentiated in two groups, like group A, group B, based on studies done by Rebecca Lansfield. This was back in the early 1900s. And what she did was extract a carbohydrate from the cell wall. And she could do some serological tests and find differences in the carbohydrate that was extracted from the cell wall. And that's how she came up with group A, because it had this carbohydrate that was extracted. Group B had a different one. But that's a very tedious, time-consuming process. It really doesn't differentiate between the species like we want. So we don't use Lansfield grouping. We use the culture and the biochemical test to speciate strep. Okay, so it's catalase negative. Again, a drop of hydrogen peroxide, no bubbles. So that's a very quick test to do. Okay, let's go to group A. The only pathogen, or the only organism, actually, in group A is strep pyogenes, which is usually a pathogen. It is 95% of the time beta-hemolytic, and it's a large zone of hemolysis. So you can see the organism here, the colonies, you can see the larger zone of hemolysis around it. Okay, it produces two enzymes, streptolysin O and streptolysin S. And these are what lyse the red blood cells to get the complete lysis, or the clearing of the beta hemolysis. Streptolysin S stands for oxygen stable. So streptolysin S is what is responsible for hemolysis on the surface of the plate, where it is in contact with oxygen. There are some strains of strep pyogenes that do not produce streptolysin S, but they produce streptolysin O, which stands for oxygen labile. Oxygen labile, which means they're destroyed by oxygen, or that enzyme is destroyed by oxygen. So in that case, if they only produce streptolysin O, then we're not going to see any hemolysis on the surface. So that's why we stab sheep blood auger in the primary quadrant, to drive the organism under the surface, away from the oxygen, so that streptolysin O can lyse the red blood cells, and in that case we would see hemolysis in the stab. That is very rare to see a strep pyogenes that produces only streptolysin O without S. I don't think I've ever seen one. But that's the reason why we stab. So the stab then is only to read hemolysis of strep. There are some other organisms that might show enhanced hemolysis, but we just disregard that if it's not a strep. But that's why you always stab the sheep blood auger. Okay, streptolysin O is antigenic, which means we can produce antibodies against it. And so there used to be, well, there still is a test, but we don't do it much anymore because we have easier means of identifying strep infections. There used to be a test called ASO titer, anti-streptolysin O titer, in which we would measure the concentration of the titer of antibodies to this enzyme. And that would give an indication of whether or not the patient had strep infection. some cases it's still done, but we don't do that much anymore. So we're not going to do an ASO titer, but you need to know what an ASO titer tests for. Okay. Group A strep is bacitracin sensitive. Bacitracin is another disc just like lomobiacin, except it's a different antibiotic. It's bacitracin. Oftentimes it's called an A disc. It has an A on it. And I'm not sure what that stands for unless it's group A. We do the same thing, do it the same way we did lomobiacin. Streak for confluent growth on sheet blood auger. You can use half a plate and then put the disc on. And we're using, we don't have to measure it because any zone size is positive. Oops, let me back up here. Okay, any zone size is positive for bacitracin. Positive meaning sensitive. So group A strep pyogenes is bacitracin sensitive. But remember, it has to be a pure culture. It has to be heavy inoculum.
Yes, Sue, I have a question. Do we always have to do streak them on sheep blood otter auger to do that? What about like ancient ones that doesn't grow well on sheep's blood?
Well, you're not going to do a bacitracin disc on ancient flu.
Yeah, but some other sort of antibiotic disc.
You do different. And we really for, we're not going to do antibiotic testing for, well, we'll get to H influenza, but you do have to do different media. For this week, for staphs and strips, they grow very well on blood. So that's the only media that we're going to use next week, is sheep blood on it. We're going to start out simple, and then we're going to get more complicated. Okay, group A is CAMP negative. I'm going to explain CAMP in just a minute. But we're actually going to do both bacitracin and the CAMP together. We can do this on one plate. Okay, let me go on to group B, and then we'll explain the CAMP test from group B. The pathogen in group B that we're concerned with is strep A galactia. B strep or strep A galactia. This is beta or gamma hemolytic. Most of it is beta hemolytic, but occasionally we can get gamma hemolysis. Okay, this and the zone of hemolysis, if it's beta hemolytic, it's a very small zone, and I'm not sure you can see that from back there, but the colony is larger than the strep pyogenes, and the zone of hemolysis is much narrower or smaller. So if you develop your discriminating eye and really look at these plates, you can begin to see these subtle differences. Okay, this one is bacitracin resistant. Classical. The classical organism is bacitracin resistant. Now, I say classical organism because, and that's the way with all of these descriptions we give, this is for the classical reaction. But these organisms don't read the textbook. So some of them don't know that they're supposed to be bacitracin resistant. And some of them will be bacitracin sensitive. So that's why we do the CAMP test along with bacitracin. Group B strep, A galactia, is CAMP positive. What is strep pyogenes? CAMP negative. Okay. Here's the CAMP test. We're going to modify this here in just a minute. But initially, what we do is we take sheep blood auger, the whole plate, sheep blood auger. We take, we're going to have some controls. It'll be in the refrigerator. There'll be CAMP controls. Staph aureus, CAMP positive staph aureus. We take our loop and put a streak of staph aureus all the way down the middle of the plate. Okay, then we take our group B strep, and we're going to start from this direction and go outward. So we take a loop full of our group B strep, start close to the staph aureus, but not touching, about a quarter of an inch away. What is a quarter of an inch translated to centimeters?
1 inch is 2.5.
1 inch is 2.5, so about
maybe half.
About a half a centimeter, so. Okay. So you don't want to touch the staph aureus, but you want to get fairly close to it, so streak in this direction. Group B strep elaborates a substance that enhances the hemolysis of CAMP-positive staph aureus. And it enhances it in such a way that it produces this arrowhead zone of hemolysis. So that's a positive CAMP test.
So those three lines in the center are all staph aureus?
No.
Or just
this is staph aureus. This is the hemolysis.
Oh, I see. So those aren't...
That's beta hemolysis. Gotcha. And group B strep produces a substance that enhances the hemolysis. So right there where it comes close together, you get the arrowhead zone. Okay. Group B strep is also sodium hippurate positive. I'm not going to go through the principle of this one. We don't have time and we're not going to use it. But hippurate positive means it changes... Whoops. It changes the medium from a colorless to a black solution. Some labs will use sodium hippurate. We're not going to do that. Okay, this is the way you really do the CAMP test. The way we're going to do it. So you have to use positive and negative controls when you do the CAMP. So take your sheep blood auger, do your streak of staph aureus down the center. Then on this side, we're going to do the controls. Okay, so we're going to have a known strep A galactia and a known strep pyogenes. Take a loop full of the A galactia, start close to the staph aureus, but not touching, and go backwards. Label this on the back of your plate so you know which is A galactia and which is pyogenes. Do the same thing for pyogenes. Take a loop full of pyogenes, start close to the staph aureus, but not touching, and going backwards. And then on the other side, you do your unknown. Has to be a strep, so you have to have at least identified it as a strep. So again, start close to the staph aureus, but not touching, go backwards, and then do confluent growth right here. Large enough confluent growth that you can put a acetracin disc. I'll show you that in just a minute, so you can put a acetracin disc on there. And that's the way we can do both the CAMP and the acetracin at the same time. Okay, here for our strep A galactia, this is our positive control, so we should see the enhanced zone of hemolysis, the arrowhead. For strep pyogenes, however, we also get a zone of hemolysis, an enhanced zone, an arrowhead, but it is usually much smaller. So that's why we have to do both positive and negative control. If we didn't, and this happened to be strep pyogenes over here, and we got some enhanced hemolysis, the arrowhead, we wouldn't know for sure if it was pyogenes or A galactia unless we have something to compare it to. So that's why you have to do the positive and negative controls. And then you compare your arrowhead to one of these to determine if it's pyogenes or A galactia. Then that's where you put your acetracin disc, right there. And so you can also determine at the same time, you incubate this for 24 hours, you look at it the next day, and you can determine if you've got resistance or sensitivity. Now remember, most agalactia should be resistant, but occasionally we get some agalactia that has a zone size. What zone size is positive for bacitracin?
Any
zone size. Okay, so if you saw any zone size here, you might automatically call it pyogenes. But then over here, you might have a little tiny, a big zone of big arrowhead. Now it's confusing. So that's why you have to remember that some agalactia can be bacitracin sensitive. But the definitive test will be the CAMP test. Okay? Got it? That's how we're going to do CAMP. Okay. Oops. Did I skip? Okay. Group B can cause some skin infections, endocarditis, which is an infection of the inner lining of the heart. We'll talk more about that. We'll get into blood infections. But most significantly, it causes neonatal septicemia or meningitis, which means that some pregnant moms, up to 35% of moms, can be carriers of strep A galactia in the vaginal tract. Doesn't do anything to them. But when the baby passes through the vaginal tract, there's about a 50 to 60% transmission rate. So that strep A galactia can be transmitted to the baby, to the neonate at the time of birth. There's two manifestations of a strep A galactia disease in the infant, early onset and late onset. Early onset means that the infant will become infected and show symptoms within about a week or less. And those symptoms are usually, well, a septicemia, blood infection, and respiratory, maybe even pneumonia. So it can be very serious. And there's about a 50% mortality in infants, too. The late onset, it occurs usually within a week to 3 months afterwards, after birth. And that's characterized more by a septicemia, which is a blood infection, and meningitis. So what usually happens is pregnant moms, right before delivery, will have a culture of the vaginal tract to determine if they are carriers of Staphylococcus. If they are, then they're usually given an antibiotic prior to birth, which will minimize the transmission of Staphylococcus to the infant.
Janice and Jacob.
Janice's carrier?
Yeah.
And Jacob?
He was breech. So he sucked it all in when it was coming out. He had early onset. So the first 10 days. Wow. Tried to die.
Trying, but you didn't want him. That's good. So that's the story of Staphylococcus. Yes.
So this happened to my cousin too, just last semester, but she had late onset and the baby got meningitis, but she was given the antibiotics when she was delivering. So I was always confused as to how that
usually they should give the antibiotic prior to delivery.
They tried to do it 24 hours before, so once she started labor, she went in, they IV'd her, and still.
Yeah. So I don't know how soon they do it before, but they need to do it a little bit before so that the antibiotic has time to work. Okay.
So I have a question. Do they, once someone is positive, do they check on the baby, or is it something that can come and go?
I don't know for sure, but I would think that they would do it for every pregnancy.
Is it usually there once it's there?
Once they're carrier, it's usually there, yeah. Okay, group D. Now, this used to be Streptococcus decalus. These things are always undergoing name changes. Now, because of differences, they found that it's not as closely related to strep as they once thought, so they put it in its own genus, and it is now Enterococcus decalus. So it's really not a group D strep because it's Enterococcus decalus. It can be normal flora, skin, upper respiratory tract, GI tract, genital urinary tract, so you can find this in a lot of places. It has variable hemolysis, which means it can be alpha, beta, or gamma. This is like gamma hemolysis. It is bioesculin positive, which, what does bioesculin positive look like?
Black.
Black, okay. And it will grow in 6.5% sodium chloride. I don't think we used that one, did we? Okay. Here's bioesculin positive. 6.5% sodium chloride is just a broth that has 6.5% salt solution in it. We inoculate that with our organism. A negative will show no growth because most organisms can't tolerate that high salt concentration. But Enterococcus can, and you see a cloudy growth. So that's a positive. Sometimes they'll put an indicator in there and it'll change the color. But I think our stalker just doesn't use the indicator, so we just look for cloudy growth as positive. So Enterococcus decalus then is both bioesculin positive and 6.5% sodium chloride positive. A newer test that has come into the laboratory is the PYR. I'm not going to go into the principle of this. We do have some discs. We can do this as either a tube or a disc. But it is beginning to replace bacitracin for strep pyogenes, and it can replace the 6.5% sodium chloride for strep. Positive PYR is red. So you can read about this one in your chapter. Okay, so it is PYR positive because it will grow at 6.5% sodium chloride, so we can substitute. We don't do both of those. It can be a pathogen in urinary tract infections, endocarditis, again, in the heart, wounds, septicemia. The reason we want to differentiate this from other organisms is because it is resistant to penicillin and some other antibiotics. So it's helpful in treatment. If it is an Enterococcus decalus, then the doc will know not to use certain antibiotics. There are different species of Enterococcus, and we're not going to speciate those. So if we do find this organism, we can just call it Enterococcus. We just assume it's Enterococcus decalus. Okay, the group D non-enterococci, this is strep. A couple species here. We're not going to speciate these. We're just going to call it group D non-enterococci. This one is bioesculin positive, so we'll see that positive in both Enterococcus and non-enterococci, but it is negative in 6.5% sodium chloride. It will not grow. Or if we do PYR, it's negative. So that's how we differentiate those two. Okay, then there's Viridin strep, which includes about 10 different species. We call them Viridin strep because they don't have a carbohydrate that can be extractable for Lancefield grouping. So there is no Lancefield group for these organisms. Strep mutans is found in the oral cavity, and this is the causative agent of some of the dental caries or the cavities that we have. And so that's one that needs to be speciated. If we come across this, we're just going to call it strep viridans. We're not going to speciate these. The couple things you need to know about strep viridans is it's usually alpha hemolytic. It's usually alpha hemolytic, but it can be gamma. It's optica negative. I'm not going to talk about that now because we're going to talk about that later when we get into lower respiratory infections, so don't worry about optica. But the thing to remember about strep viridans is that it causes 50% of endocarditis. So different organisms that cause it, as we've seen, but this is causes the majority of it, and that can be a very serious heart infection that we'll talk about later. Okay. Now, I'm going to do a little bit of a lab procedure now because on Tuesday, we don't have lecture on Monday to explain this, so I'm going to explain now what you're going to be doing so you'll know what to do come Tuesday. This says Monday, but unless you want to come Monday, this should be Tuesday. Okay, so we're going to start with knowns and unknowns next week. The knowns are known organisms, so we're going to have cultures that are identified. They will be labeled as Staph aureus, Staph saprophyticus, Strep pyogenes, Enterococcus, and Strep aglantia. Those are the knowns. You do these in pairs. There's five of them, so that means one of you will do three and one of you will do two. Okay, but that means also that you have to look at your partners. You have to look at all results. Now, the reason, again, I explained before, but the reason we're doing knowns is so that you can see as many different organisms as possible and see the reactions as many times as possible. That's the way you learn. Okay, now, because these are pure cultures, these are known cultures and pure cultures, in order to save time, since next week is a short week, time and media, whoever streaks out, you can streak for isolation on sheep blood auger. Whoever streaks Staph saprophyticus will put a novobiocin disc on the primary quadrant, because that's good for growth. And the way you put the disc on, again, is you use forceps. You put the forceps in ethyl alcohol, and then you flame them. So you have to go to a Bunsen burner and flame them. And then you can take a disc and put it on the plate. And then flame the forceps afterwards. Okay, strep pyogenes, whoever does that one, will put a bacitracin disc on the primary quadrant where we have confluent growth. And whoever does strep agalactia will put a bacitracin disc on. Now again, the reason we're putting these discs on is because we know these are pure cultures. You cannot use those discs on mixed cultures. Okay, for your unknown, you will each have an unknown. And this is going to be a skin aspirate. We're dealing with skin infections. And we're going to be using different worksheets next week, so I'll hand those out to you. You're going to use a sheep blood auger, so you'll streak for isolation. You're going to do a Gram stain, and that will give you your preliminary identification. Since we're only dealing with Staphs and Streps next week, you know it's going to be Gram-positive coxa. So don't bring the cordia Gram-negative rods. Okay, you also have to do a Gram stain on the gnomes. So you streak your plates, streak for isolation of sheep blood auger, do Gram stain on the gnomes, and look at your partner's Gram stain so you get used to looking at what these different things look like. Okay, so Tuesday you're going to take the quiz first, then you're going to streak out your plates. Wednesday you'll start reading your plates. You also have to Gram stain, even though you Gram stain your unknown organism from the broth, you'll be getting the broth, which is a skin aspirate. You also have to Gram stain it from the colony growth. Okay? So the next day, on Wednesday, you're going to do more Gram stains of whatever organisms grow on your plate. And then you follow the flow chart, and I'll show you the flow chart here in just a minute. In red, everybody awake? Everybody listening? Do all appropriate tests on knowns and unknown organisms. So the knowns, even though you know it's Staph aureus, you're still going to follow the flow diagram. Friday is when you turn in your reports, and you know where the boxes are in most rooms to turn in. Now, sometimes I used to have students turn in plates and tubes so I could check to see how you were streaking and things, but I don't want to do that. There's too many of you, so we're going to just kind of go around the rooms during the week and look at stuff. So don't turn in your tubes and plates unless I tell you specifically to.
But this Friday, the homework to do, is it the second half that's included?
Yes. You have, for this Friday, you will have the plate, the media, you'll have Kirby Bauer that you're going to read today, and you'll have the Graham stains that you're going to start on today. So you'll have three things to turn in this Friday. Okay, here's the flow diagram. This is in your packet, your syllabus, whatever it's called. Okay, so make sure you bring this to lab, because this is what you're going to use. So do not come to Bill or Marilyn or Dean and say, what do I do?
Can you make that slide online, too, so maybe we can kind of figure, because it's pretty hard to see.
Yeah. They have the same slides on page 42.
There's a bigger one in there.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, this is what we're going to do. This is for gram-positive cocci. So whenever you encounter gram-positive cocci throughout the semester, and we can see these anytime throughout the semester, not just this week, but anytime. Okay, first thing you're going to do is your gram stain. You know it's gram-positive cocci, you're going to do catalase. You remember how to do the catalase. If it's catalase positive, we know we're dealing with staph. So we'll follow this part of the flow diagram. We have to differentiate aureus, epidermidis, and saprophyticus. First thing we're going to do is coagulase test. You know how to do that. If it's coagulase positive, it's staph aureus, and that's all we have to do. We are not doing DNAs, so we know it's staph aureus. If it is coagulase negative, then what do? Novobiosin. We remember how to do the novobiosin. Okay, if it's novobiosin sensitive, it's staph epidermidis. If it's novobiosin resistant, it's staph saprophyticus. So that's all we have to do for staphs. Pretty simple. Okay, for strep, if it's catalase negative, then we're dealing with strep, as long as we know we have gram-positive cocci. Okay, then we have to look at the hemolysis. That's why it's so important to be able to differentiate hemolysis. If it is alpha hemolytic, it could be enterococci. Enterococci or group D non-enterococci could be any of these because the hemolysis is variable. So we'll just set up a bioesculin and a 6.5% sodium chloride. Set both of those up at the same time. Okay, we don't shotgun, which means, like over here, we don't set up a coagulase and a novobiosin at the same time. We have to do these in order because if this coagulase is positive, we don't even need the novobiosin and we would have wasted media. Okay, so don't shotgun. So, but you can set up the bioesculin and the sodium chloride at the same time. The PYR, again, is a substitute for sodium chloride. So we may use that depending upon how much we have. Okay, now down here, it tells about opticum. Don't, let's see, I think I've got, yeah, don't do that. Okay, we're not doing this part. So stop at this point. If it's beta hemolytic, then we have to differentiate between group A strep and group B strep primarily. So we're going to set up the bacitracin and the CAMP at the same time, and you know how to do that now. Okay, if both of those don't tell us anything definitive, it could be a beta hemolytic enterococci or group D non enterococci. So at that point, we would set up bioesculin and sodium chloride. Over here, if it's gamma hemolytic to start with, then again we do the bioesculin and the sodium chloride, 6.5% sodium chloride, and we're looking for either enterococci or group D non enterococci. So everybody understand that, how to use the flow diagram. So on your known organisms, if you have a known staph aureus, you do the same things. You do the gram stain, you do a catalase, you do a coagulase. If you have a known strep pyogenes, you do the gram stain, you do the catalase, you do the bacitracin in the CAMP. Okay, so the knowns, you do everything on the flow diagram. Now, this is the report sheet that you will get and have recorded. And I'll explain this on Tuesday, because really all you have to do, or I'll explain this on Wednesday, all you have to do on Tuesday is mark off, the smear report is your first gram stain, gram-positive cocci. That's, you should see gram-positive cocci and only gram-positive cocci. And then you put the date down. What's the date on Tuesday? 19th. And you put the media that you inoculated. And the only thing we're going to use is sheep blood auger. And then on Wednesday, we're going to come in and look at it. So I'll explain the rest of this on Wednesday. The front page is for your unknowns. The knowns you put on the reverse. So again, I'll explain the rest of this on Wednesday. Okay, let's go do it.